for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. In her descent of Kilo versus City of New London, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor said, the government now has license to transfer property from those with fewer resources to those with more. The ruling set off a firestorm of controversy and raised questions about just how far the government can go in taking private property and what constitutes a public use. A new book tells the story of the woman whose house was at the heart of the case. The book is titled Little Pink House, and author Jeff Benedict joins me in the studio. Jeff Benedict is an investigative journalist. He's authored 7 books. He teaches writing at Southern Virginia University. Do join us. Questions, comments, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to you, Jeff.
Good morning, Diane.
I must say, the more I read about this, the more unbelievable the whole situation became. Give us, in a nutshell, the significance of this case.
Well, the significance is that prior to Kilo versus New London, the rule was simple. The government can take private property for public use. This case changed it because the city of New London wasn't taking private property for public use. They were taking private property for private use. They were turning it over to a developer to build a hotel and a spa and upscale housing in hopes that it would generate higher tax revenues and stimulate jobs. That's not a public use. It's a public benefit. And now we've equated benefits with uses. And as Sandra Day O'Connor basically said in the dissent, where's the line?
What were the development plans and who was behind them?
The development plans really, that was my question as a journalist. We all know the end of the story. Where does this story start? How does a little neighborhood fight become a federal case? It started because the city of New London was depressed, and the state of Connecticut had a governor at the time, John Rowland, who was immensely popular, Republican governor, looking to break into a Democratic stronghold like New London. He proposes an urban renewal plan. They lure Pfizer to New London to build a global research and development facility, the largest pharmaceutical in the world. Pfizer looks at it and says, we don't really want to come there. But Connecticut gives them enough incentives, all kinds of things they
were
going to do.
Tax breaks,
free property on the waterfront, tax abatements for 10 years, all kinds of things. But the big thing that no one really paid attention to, it's the little detail, was they also promised that they'd take 90 acres around the Pfizer facility and raise it, clear it, erase it, and build new things that would complement a corporate facility, i.e. a 5-star hotel, the spa, and everything else. And one homeowner, Suzette Kilo, stood up and said, wait a minute, I just got here. It's the first time in her life, a 42-year-old divorced nurse. She'd never owned anything before. She's finally got a piece of paper in her hand that says, I own this place. And now the government comes in and says, if you don't sell it to us, we're going to condemn it and take it. So starts the battle.
The New London Development Commission played a very major role here. Tell us about that.
The governor was looking for a way around the New London politics because it's so democratically controlled. He's Republican. So they set up something called the New London Development Corporation. It's a quasi-private institution. The governor or the state gives them the money, and they basically do what the state says. And they picked a college president named Claire Gaudiani from Connecticut College to run the development agency. She'd never built anything in her life. Very smart woman, very aggressive, very competent. But this is an enormous development plan. And the plan was, do it on Pfizer time. We've got to do this fast. So things happen very, very fast. And one of the things that Claire and the NLDC want to do is just buy out that whole neighborhood. The problem is, most of the families in the neighborhood had been there for 3 generations.
They were wanted to stay there.
They wanted to stay. Yeah. I mean, one lady was pushing 90. She'd been born in her house. And she hadn't had a mortgage in 40 or 50 years. Just wanted to stay in her home. And the fact is, what I think what's really amazing here is, but at the end of the day, the city bulldozed their way to getting 87 acres. They had only three left to get, and it's the 3 acres where these little houses were. And they wouldn't settle for 87. They had to have the last three. Mm. And this thing goes to trial, and the trial judge in this case says, you're wrong. The city broke the law. These people should be allowed to stay in their homes, and you think it's going to have a great ending, but that's not how it ends.
Jeff Benedict, his new book is titled Little Pink House, A True Story of Defiance and Courage. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. At the time all this was happening, Pfizer was getting ready to launch a major new product.
Absolutely. The timing here, Diane, as I was reporting this, it was amazing to me. You can't make this up. Literally at the same month that Claire Guadagnini and the New London Development Corporation approached Pfizer on behalf of the state in hopes of convincing Pfizer to come to New London, Pfizer has just learned that they've got a drug that failed in its trials for what they hoped it would do. But when the trial was over, all the women returned their drugs. The men didn't. They look into it. Why? This drug helps with impotence. They give it a new name, Viagra, and they send it off to the FDA. While they're trying to fast-track this drug through the FDA, they are lured by the governor into coming into New London. And so now they've got two things going on. They're building a huge R&D facility in New London, acquiring property, and they're pushing Viagra through, and they both basically come through at the same time. Building goes up, drug gets approved.
So all of this is happening as somehow, in somebody's mind, public use is being redefined.
Yes, because the city looked at this saying, look, about 50% of the real estate in New London can't be developed. It's owned by government agencies, nonprofits, military bases, et cetera, et cetera. We need a large tract of land. And if we can't buy it, then we'll condemn it and use eminent domain to take it because the city needs jobs and it needs more taxes. And that's really the simplicity of the analysis here.
But if you've got a governor who resists that kind of thing, that is saying simply, we need more taxes, therefore we have the right to eminent domain, then you've got a conflict. But you had the governor going along with this.
The state really, I think, unleashed a monster here. I mean, what they thought in the beginning was this is going to be great for Connecticut and great for the city. Everybody wins. Great for Pfizer. There's no losers here. I don't think anybody anticipated in the beginning that, first of all, nobody really paid attention that because a lot of the properties in this 90-acre area, frankly and candidly, were industrial. They were business enterprises, and if they could be bought out at fair market value, fine. That's kind of the American way.
Sure.
But nobody paid attention to the fact that there were essentially two blocks of houses that had been there for a long, long time. And what about them? I mean, this was the kind of community where people didn't lock their doors at night. Everybody knew everybody. And they weren't opposed to the development, by the way. They liked the idea that there was going to be some development there. They just wanted to stay and be part of it.
Tell me about Suzette Kilo and her house in particular, because that house has history.
That house has history. It's over 100 years old. This is what amazed me. I interviewed the real estate agent who sold this house to her. He'd never sold a house before. He had just got his license. He said, one day I got a call, brand new on the job. I get a call, and the lady introduced herself as Suzette Kilo, wanted to look at a house on 8 East Street, New London. He said, I didn't even know where that was. He had to grab the listing sheet. He looked at it. He said, gosh, this is old. It looks like it's run down. It's not worth much. He gets back on the phone. When would you like to see it? Today. Oh, well, let me get you some directions. I'm outside the house right now. He says, oh, well, I'll meet you down there.
Yeah.
And here's what amazed me. He said, when I got there, he said, I noticed her feet were bleeding. And I said, your feet were bleeding? He said, yeah, she was wearing sandals. And the house was obstructed by briars and prickers and stuff. She had brought hedge clippers in her car, and he said she was cutting her way through to get to the door and had cut up her legs and sandals. And he said, when I pointed out to her that she was bleeding, it was like it didn't even faze her. He said she was so eager to get in the house. And he said, when I got in the house, here I am a new agent trying to sell my first house. And when I saw the inside, I started trying to talk her out of buying the house. And all she did was open the window, the big picture window, which was obstructed by old drab curtains. And when she did, light rushed into the room. You could see the water. He said she basically didn't leave the window. She wanted to buy the house.
She wanted to buy the house and bought it for how much?
She bought it for about $52,000. The asking price was around 70. She got it for in the low 50s. She took a first-time home buyer's loan, a government program, got the house, borrowed about $2,000 from her friend for the down payment, moved in, sanded the floors by hand, puttied all the holes. The reason the house ends up pink, it wasn't a pink house when she bought it. It was gray and ugly. She painted it Odessa Rose, which is like a salmon pink color, because when she talked to a historic preservationist, a painter, he said that would be the appropriate color for this house if you look at the time period in the construction. And now when you look at the house, or I should say before the city did what it did, you look at this house and say, my goodness, this is a million miles from blight. This is a beautiful cottage on the shore in Connecticut. Why in the world would anybody condemn this and want to knock it down?
It had originally been constructed in 1890 by a locally prominent carpenter and then relocated.
Yes, it was relocated many years ago and into this neighborhood along with another house right next to it. They actually, those two houses came together. They were identical houses. And both of them were vacant when Suzette showed up and bought this.
Jeff Benedict, and we're talking about his brand new book. It's titled Little Pink House, A Story of Defiance and Courage, One Woman's Historic Battle Against Eminent Domain. If you've just joined us, Jeff Benedict is with me, longtime journalist, reporter, writer of books. He's written 8 books now, and this one, titled Little Pink House, is a mind-blowing story about what government, local government, national government, local courts, Supreme Court of the United States can do with the issue of eminent domain. And we are going to take your calls shortly, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Jeff Benedict, what year did Suzette buy the house?
In 1997.
And when did she get first notice that this whole thing was happening?
Bought the house in fall of 97, and on February 2nd, 1998, Pfizer and the governor and the city announced right outside her neighborhood that Pfizer was coming, and 2 days later, real estate agents showed up at Suzette's house asking to buy the house.
Asking to buy it?
To option it, technically, to purchase an option on the house. She said, not interested, just got here. They were back within a week, up the offer, up the pressure, and this time Suzette basically told her to get out of here and threatened to throw her off the porch if she came back.
And then?
And then she got a letter essentially telling her, look, you don't
take
really,
this or...
You don't have any choice. Letters went to all the people in the neighborhood actually talking about a government process that was going to start if they didn't sell willingly.
What can keep government from taking private homes that way?
What can? I mean, one thing that can is just good laws on a state-by-state or a county-by-county basis. And some states have them. Connecticut has some of the worst eminent domain laws probably in the country.
What did she then try to do to keep her home?
Well, the funny thing is she called the mayor, who was brand new. He'd been in town for years, but he's a brand new mayor, just been elected. And she called him up and she said, should I be concerned about this? And he said, yes, you should. He comes over and meets with her. The mayor knows the deal, and he doesn't like it. But he knows the deck is stacked. And he meets with her, and he brings a community activist with her named Kathleen Mitchell. And they basically tell Suzette, look, here's what it's going to take. You've got to go door to door and get petitions signed. You're going to have to go to public meetings. You're going to have to form a neighborhood coalition. You're going to have to write letters to the editor. She says, wait a minute here. She's just come out of a divorce. She's just raised five sons. She's moved here to start her life over. She didn't come here to get into this. And the mayor basically looks at her and says, do you want to save your home? Well, yeah. Then go door to door. And he tells her before he leaves that day, he says, this is going to be the fight from hell, and you are going to become the poster child for eminent domain. Now, that's in the spring of 1998. There is no court case. There's no battle yet, nothing. I don't think even the mayor had an inkling of what he was predicting. But within a couple of years, the mayor would get arrested himself, prostrate on the steps of a house on Suzette Street, trying to block a bulldozer from knocking houses down. The police, which he employs, come and cart him off and throw him in a police car. These are the kind of stories that are here. It's an unbelievable.
All right. So what happens when the residents of her town find out that all this is happening, that Pfizer is coming in simply taking this property? Obviously, the state government is willing to pay her for the property. She simply doesn't want to sell. What happens when the rest of the town finds out?
When the town starts to realize what's really going on, including the local newspaper, starts
right.
to see what's going on,
right.
they start filing Freedom of Information requests, and the agency's not giving over documents, the public gets pretty outraged, and a coalition does form, and the neighborhood does it, and professors from Connecticut College, local architects, smart people who know how to get things done come together and say, we got to save this place. And essentially, they work and fight for 2 years, and they get nowhere. They get absolutely no. They do everything that they teach you to do in a democracy to get your voice heard, and none of it matters.
Why not?
Because I think the fix was in. In other words, they had a goal to get to, which was raise the neighborhood. They didn't want one parcel left. They wanted to be able to go to a developer and say, look, we have an entire 90-acre landscape for you to work with. And so there was no even entertaining the idea of what about incorporating an old historic residential neighborhood into a new urban plan. They just weren't going to go there. And it wasn't until lawyers got involved, which took almost 3 years before lawyers showed up from the Institute for Justice, that this became a battle that was somewhat fair.
And meanwhile, she's continuing to live in her house.
Never left. There's an unbelievable scene the same day that the mayor gets carted off in handcuffs. As the bulldozer moves down the street and gets to Suzette's, the house right next to hers, they're chewing the house down with the claws of the machine, and she's out there with a broom trying to sweep glass and debris off her porch. She's getting sprayed in the head and everything else with all this stuff. They pull her off the porch. The police have to come. I think she drank herself to sleep that night, because when she wakes up in the morning, all the houses next to her are gone. Her house is alone. And the guy who knocked them down, this guy named Chico Barbieri, can't make these names up, shows up at her house. Guy looks like Rocky Balboa, and he's got a gift of scented soaps, and he brings it in the house, and he throws his big arms around her and says, I'll never knock down your house. She's crying, and amazingly, this tells you something about her. She takes this guy in the house and gets him a cup of coffee, sits him down, they become friends. You start to see that this is a pretty complex, and in my mind, unique woman here that would do the things that Suzette Kilo does. She's not your ordinary American.
She is an emergency room nurse working even as we speak. We've been trying to get a hold of her, trying to reach her so that she might be able to participate at least briefly in this morning's program. But you are welcome. Join us on 800-433-8850. Now, Jeff, lead up to the lawsuit for us.
Well, the Neighborhood Coalition had come together, and when everything failed, there's a meeting they have one day where they're all sitting there and they go, you know, we need to get real. And real means we need lawyers. Yeah, but we don't have any money for lawyers. And one of the people in the group had heard about this outfit called the Institute for Justice in Washington, D.C. They had just won a case involving a woman in Atlantic City who was having her home taken for a limo parking lot for Donald Trump. The Institute for Justice helped her prevail, so they thought, why don't we contact them? They write a letter. You know, what's the likelihood that that thing's going to actually get them anywhere? It ends up on the desk of a young lawyer named Scott Bullock. He reads it. He's compelled. He flies up there. He first drives down the street of this neighborhood, and he goes, this is blighted? I mean, he's stunned that this is the kind of neighborhood that they're trying to knock down. He interviews Suzette in the Pink House, and all the neighbors come, and he goes around the room and talks to everybody. He's particularly compelled by Suzette. And I think right in the beginning he thought, if we were to take this case, she's clearly the leader. And that's the start. And within probably 4 months from his visit, the Institute for Justice decides to take the case. And by December of that year, they file a suit in New London. And then there is a trial over whether or not the city has the right to do this.
You know, we should say here that the city council voted 6-1 to support this development plan. It's only the mayor who dissents. So he loses, and the mayor, God love him, sits in front of this bulldozer and gets arrested. All right, so we carry on with this lawsuit. Where does it go from here?
Goes to trial court, and it's a terrific trial. I mean, it really is. It's only in America could you see this kind of thing. And all the homeowners get the chance to testify. Suzette's a compelling witness, of course. The trial judge is from out of town. They can't use a New London judge because I think every one of them would have been conflicted on this case. And they bring in an outside judge who happens to be Italian. He comes in. He hears the case. He rules favorably. And the headline the next day is eminently their domain. Everybody loves it. It's party time, but it's short-lived because there's an appeal to the Connecticut Pretty immediate. And the Connecticut Supreme Court rules 3-2 that the lower court was wrong. Everybody has to go. And so the Institute for Justice and the homeowners appealed to the United States Supreme Court. I think most people thought they'll never take the case. They don't hardly ever take eminent domain cases. I mean, it had really been since 1954 that they'd had a real eminent domain case, even similar to this. And so they take the case, amazingly. And I know at that point, I was following it pretty closely by then, and I thought, they're going to win. I mean, why else would they take this case? But that's an overly simplified analysis. That's not why they take cases. And amazingly, they go in there, and there's this, I think, the telltale moment. Both sides knew this was going to be close. But the city's lawyers wisely focused their argument on two justices, Kennedy and O'Connor. They targeted their whole argument, really, toward them. And they kind of forgot about everybody else because they figured that was going to be the swing. And there's this debate between the lawyers on the city side. Should we just admit up front that our theory, if taken to its extreme, would allow you to bulldoze a Motel 6 to bring in, you know, a much more expensive hotel? And the answer is yes, but do we want to admit that? Because that essentially makes the Institute for Justice's argument. They do it. I mean, the question comes right up in the beginning from Sandra Day O'Connor and Justice Scalia. And it's an amazing exchange between them. And when the city's attorney says, yes, you can do that, Scalia says, let me just make sure I get this straight. You can take from A and give to B if B can pay more taxes. And the attorney says, as long as it's, you know, much more taxes. And Scalia says, well, I'll accept that. That's the argument. If you can get more taxes out of somebody else using that property than under Kelo, you can do it. And I think that's what swung O'Connor to go on the side of the property owners. I think she probably was going to go the other way initially. But she goes over, but Kennedy doesn't, and it goes 5-4.
But you know, what is so extraordinary here is very concisely put into an email to us from Victoria, who says, "Here's what I don't understand. Conservatives are always talking about property rights. Actually, it's a mantra with him as one of the main keys to economic health. So how is it that a Supreme Court loaded with conservatives ruled in favor of the government seizing private property for the benefit of other private entities, but that's not what happened?"
Now, that's an easy question to answer, actually. This decision was handed down in 2005. It wasn't a court dominated by Republicans. Rehnquist, Scalia, Thomas, and O'Connor voted for the property owners.
Exactly.
It was the five other justices on the liberal side that went for big business.
How do you figure?
It's upside down. I mean, a lot of you look at this and you say, wait a second here. This is all backwards.
Totally. And how do you justify it?
I think what happened here was Justice Ginsburg, Justice Breyer. I mean, you can see this in the oral argument if you go back and read the transcripts. What they were looking at was this was a poor city, high minority population, highest jobless rate in the state of Connecticut. They were looking for a way to stimulate jobs and grow the economy. And they defined this as a public benefit. And as soon as you put public benefits on parallel with public uses, you can do this.
At 26 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. But here's the kicker, Jeff. What's been done with that property?
Nothing. I was just there a little over a month ago. And amazingly, the city hasn't built anything there. They got the go-ahead to knock it all down. They did. I think the only jobs that were created by this whole mess was for demolition crews who operated the bulldozers to plow these buildings down and the dump trucks that drove the debris out of there. It's a 90-acre wasteland, and there are no new things.
What happened to Pfizer?
Well, Pfizer, everything happened to Pfizer. The building went up in record time. It's up and running. They got the facility going. If you go there today, you see this huge Pfizer facility. But what didn't happen that Pfizer wanted was a new community around them. They didn't, as one of their people were quoted in a Hartford Current story saying, "You don't want to look out our windows and see tenement buildings." Well, what you look out and see now is a wasteland. It's dirt, weeds, and streets with no names. That's what you have up there. It's you can't imagine that this could happen, but that's exactly what happened.
All right, let's open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Rose Marie in Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Certainly can. Go right ahead.
Thank you. My grandfather owned acres of land in New Britain, Connecticut. He had a house wrecking business, and the same thing happened. They condemned the land and took it over for the John Downey Industrial Park. And that happened 50, 60 years ago. I can't believe that it's still going on.
It is. You know what? Amazingly, this went on in New London, too. In the 1970s, New London took land by eminent domain, and they didn't build anything. You'd think at some point you start to learn from the past, but in this case, I think it, Diane, really came down to pride and local politics that got in the way of the ability to reach what I thought would have been some real sensible compromises here. They could have got their development. They could have built all the things they wanted to build, and these homeowners could have stayed. It could have all happened.
Here's an email from Matt in Raleigh, North Carolina, who says, "I recall the day this ruling came down, discussing it with my father. Our conclusion was this was the worst Supreme Court ruling of the last 50 years. I also remember a few hotel companies being set up and attempting to stake claims on the homes of some influential members of the judiciary and politicians in protest. But my knowledge on how to unwind all this is limited. If the Supreme Court is truly the highest adjudicator of what is legal or illegal in the land, what or who could undo this ruling?
That's a good question, Diane. And I think probably the best way to do this is state by state. And in fact, one of the outcomes of this case is that 43 states have changed their laws as a direct response to Kelo.
The book is titled Little Pink House, A True Story of Defiance and Courage. Jeff Benedict is the author, and it really tells the story of one woman's historic battle against eminent domain. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth in foster care, on the web at aecf.org. By Kauffman, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, committed to growing economies and expanding human welfare, on the web at kauffman.org. And by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I need another world.
There's something otherworldly about Anthony's singing. John Hodgman described Anthony's voice as somewhere between male and female, between childish innocence and weary adulthood. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Anthony about his music and about being transgendered. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Never seen the light.
And right off the bat, many questions for Jeff Benedict on eminent domain. First of all, what are the benefits of eminent domain for public use? Roads, schools, firehouses, etc.
It's a tool that's been in the government's hands since the formation of our Constitution. Under the Fifth Amendment, there are uses, good uses, for eminent domain. When we need public highways, airports, public buildings, courthouses, police stations, hospitals. There's plenty of uses. Oftentimes, Diane, those buildings can be built and property can be acquired without resorting to eminent domain. But in instances, there are reasons for the government to have this power. But that's a long ways from this case.
Does this case imply that a developer can now force a local government to condemn and sell them land if a public benefit can be demonstrated?
No, it doesn't. But what it does make, or put at risk, is the ability for a developer to say to local government, look, you know, here's what we could do here. And in fact, there are cases like that right now in the United States where developers or businessmen have persuaded local government that, look, we could put much better use to this property and generate a lot more revenue if the city took the property.
All right. And let's go now to Phoenix, Arizona. Good morning, Barney. You're on the air. Barney, are you there? I guess not. Let's go to Niantic, Connecticut. Troy, good morning.
Good morning, Diane. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I was wondering, I'm sure Jeff realizes this, but they didn't actually raise her house. They moved it to another part of town.
Hello, Troy. Good morning. In fact,
hi, good morning.
It's great. He's brought up a great sort of ending to this story, is that it's the only house in the Fort Trumbull neighborhood that is preserved, and because she's the last one to leave. And one of the agreements that was made with the governor's office was that, yes, she had to go and the house had to go, but the house could be saved. It's taken down board by board, and it was transported to another lot in town, which was donated for this house to be reconstructed on. It sits there today. It looks almost exactly like it did before, but there's been some addition put on the house. It's a historic landmark. You can go there and visit it today.
Does she live there?
She does not.
Why not?
She had to give it up. I mean, that was part of the agreement. She left New London and had to give up the house.
She moved to Groton.
Yeah, she moved across the river.
I see.
And the guy who did the historic restoration, he does live in the house. He lives down in a basement-level apartment.
Troy, I thank you for calling and adding to the discussion.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. Let's go now to Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And without diminishing the human dimension of this compelling story, I think, as the author points out, there's a very complex issue that still is not adequately addressed, certainly in a time of increasing pressure on old cities and government to provide for the citizenry. And that issue is the distinction between public use and public benefit. I think in an era of public-private partnership and the needs of citizenry, whether it be roads or whether it be job creation, are artificial distinctions. So the question I'd ask, and frankly I've had to face it myself as the chairman of a port authority in my hometown, is how do you balance those interests of public and private? And, you know, the facts in New London were egregious, and I'm not here to defend them, but I am here to raise that important question. Job creation, new business, without conceding to the sometimes overreaching demands of a corporation, how do you balance that? I'd be interested in the author's perspective.
Sure.
And those of other callers.
Sure. Jeff?
Thanks, Michael, because that is a good question. It's the tough question.
Of course.
I think that, look, I'm not an expert on policy planning and urban renewal. I'm a writer. But in looking at this, what struck me was that I think most of the time there's a compromise. There's a way to work with people that makes good business sense and is also fair. And most of the time, you don't need to resort to the club, which is eminent domain. In this case, the facts are egregious, but the fact is, Diane, in the beginning, they weren't egregious. This was a standard kind of situation that develops all over the United States. They chose a path that's different. They could have said, look, urban renewal? Well, let's look at some other cities in New England that have done waterfront urban renewal. Do they just knock everything down? No. There's things you can incorporate that would have actually made that development even more valuable, like historic homes. And this community had historic homes. So I think it doesn't have to be black or white, this or that. There's an opportunity oftentimes in these situations to work together, make it profitable for all sides.
Here's an email from Kenya, who is a condemnation eminent domain attorney in Charlotte, North Carolina. She says one of the benefits of the Kelo decision was that it outraged so many people across the political spectrum. As a result, many state legislators restricted in some way their state's power to take private property for public use. The Kelo backlash actually strengthened the private property rights of people in those states.
She's absolutely right. This story has an O. Henry ending. I mean, you expect that when they lose 5-4 at the Supreme Court, that's just a horrible ending. And if it had ended there, it would have been horrible. But the fact is, it didn't end there. It touched off, as she's indicated, a firestorm of controversy. And that's why I think the fight that Suzette and her neighbors waged here had real meaning. It's the kind of thing that I presume 100 years from now, our students will read this in textbooks as one of those cases.
Interesting. To Frank, who's in Lovettsville, Virginia. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
My wife and I have had an assisted living facility, a small one, about 20 beds in Lovettsville for 20-some years now. And there's this big coal-powered plant in West Virginia that wants to send power to New Jersey. And they're going to bring these huge 200-foot power lines, not on my property, but right contiguous to it, such that if the power line fell, it would probably land maybe within 50 feet of my property. Needless to say, I can see a lot of my new residents' families saying, hey, we don't want to put our mom in your home because they have, you know, pacemakers and we don't know what the effects of this. What are my options here? I mean, it's like a lose-lose for us. We could never get any money for it. I don't see an option. Where am I?
I'm not the legal expert on that. All I can say is this. There are lots of other ways. If you took eminent domain off the table, there's lots of other ways for a municipality to do the same kind of damage or property value diminution that happens in an eminent domain case, and that's one of them. And so even if you were to clean up eminent domain completely, it wouldn't take care of things like the situation he's just described.
So what are his rights at this point?
Well, I mean, obviously, I'm not the guy to give you advice on that.
Yeah.
I mean, he'd certainly need to talk to lawyers who specialize in this area, but it just shows you how complex this is. There's lots of ways that a government can really get its way when it comes to property use.
Yeah, they say that Loudoun County is going to be against it, but that the Virginia State Corporation Commission is, basically connected with these power companies in West Virginia, and they're willing to let them do that. And so there we are. You know, it's a damn shame.
Well, good luck to you, Frank. Don't give up.
Thank you, Diane. I've loved listening to you over the years. My first call ever. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Let's go to Marcia, who's in Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I love your show. Listen
Thank you.
Frequently.
Oh, and good.
This is a subject that made me become politically active after 50 years of life not being politically active. My local government decided they would devalue everyone's property by building a strip mall with low interest rates and all that, abutting people's property. And we got organized, did something about it. But the issue that I had is it was secret. Even though my husband and I and our neighbors read our weekly paper, kept up, all of this was in secrecy until we found out about it, went up, talked about it to the township, and they said, you can't do anything about this. This is already in stage whatever.
Marcia, that's a great comment, and those are exactly the things that Suzette Kilo and her neighborhood, New London, heard and were told. A lot of it was done in secret, meaning these are closed-door meetings where people are planning what we're going to do here, and then at some point the public starts to learn about it, and it's difficult to get all the information. People who are going about their lives, working, paying taxes, putting kids on school buses, you don't have time to spend 10 hours a day going through all this paperwork trying to ferret out what's going on. And that's this, to me, Diane, this story is instructive in a lot of ways about how our system works and how to make the system work for you. Because what these folks did in New London is quite extraordinary, but it also shows you how uphill it is.
All right, to Frankfort, Delaware, and to Pat. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question I haven't heard anybody answer. Has the Pfizer deal been shown to be a budgetary benefit to the state? I read a couple of books by David K. Johnston, a New York Times reporter, who suggests that many times tax incentives are given to some of the corporations. Maybe the one example I can think of is New York Yankee Stadium, and that they end up actually being a negative to the budget instead of a positive thing.
Pat, great comment. And here in this case, I'm from Connecticut. I don't see what benefit the state got here, because they got a corporation, but they gave them 10 years of tax abatement. They gave them free property. They did all the environmental cleanup. And yes, they brought some people in, but they didn't really add that many jobs. And now Pfizer just announced they're cutting jobs, including at that particular plant. So I'm not sure what really the uptick was for the state or the city.
Maybe it's going to take some time to really find out.
as a footnote, if I could, my father-in-law is a state senator in Delaware who put an eminent domain bill, and it passed unanimously in both houses, and the governor vetoed that bill. This year, it's a new governor, Governor Markell, and he has promised if the legislature will get it to him, he will sign the bill, essentially doing away with those kinds of cases like the Kelo case.
Good for you, Pat. Thanks.
All right,
to
thank
your
you.
Father as well.
Thanks.
All right, we've got a question here. After the Supreme Court decision, what happened to Justice Souter's house that somebody wanted to, quote, take?
An activist from Los Angeles who was so outraged by the Kelo decision organized a protest. Justice Souter has a house in New Hampshire.
Back in the woods somewhere.
In a beautiful area. And a whole bunch of people went up there and paraded around the property outside and demanded that the house be taken by eminent domain. Of course, that didn't happen, but it brought an awful lot of attention to the irony of the whole situation.
I see. All right. And to Kevin here in Washington, D.C. at 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Go right ahead, Kevin.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling with a comment more than anything else, really, and that is that these cases can have an enormous human cost, take a human toll on families. My mother was involved in a similar case in Kentucky. Local town Bellevue, Kentucky, took her home for a condominium development on the Ohio River, and she was winning the case, won two judgments in the Kentucky Supreme Court. And then the city suddenly changed its arguments and said that they wanted the home not for condominiums but for street widening. And at that, her lawyer folded on her. And she has been being forced to move from her home that was her parents' home for 70 years. And in December, she was going through some of my grandfather's things. And the next thing I heard from my sister was that she had a stroke.
Oh.
And so... these developers may argue that they're bringing jobs and economic development to cities and towns, but when they take a home that a person has lived most of her life in, my mother's now 80 years old, they're doing something to people that I think they don't take into consideration, that you can't put a number or a figure on.
Kevin, you're so absolutely right. I mean, the idea that the kind of stress that this must put on people who are involved in these kinds of cases. I'm so sorry about your mother. How is she now?
She was released from the hospital yesterday, but we found another home for her to live in. But the people who were looking after her in a rehabilitation hospital have advised us that she cannot live alone because she'll be in an unfamiliar environment. So she's now living with my sister, at least temporarily.
Wow.
There's a story in Little Pink House about a woman in her late 80s who'd been born in her house, and she's one of the plaintiffs with Suzette. She holds out, and she just wanted to die in her home. And right after the Supreme Court decision comes down, she does. And it's amazing because there'd been a number of other elderly neighbors who died while this case was being litigated. And it was awful. I mean, they were going into nursing homes. They were scared to death because these are people who can't even put their, you know, sign their names on a paper to say, I don't want to sell my home. Suzette was literally helping them sign their names to petition forms and stuff. That's how elderly a lot of these folks were. And they end up in nursing homes, driven out of their houses before this case is settled.
So you said that 43 states have toughened their laws about the whole issue of eminent domain. What about the other seven, the holdouts?
Well, New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut, I mean, some of the states in the Northeast, I think, have some of the toughest, or you could say worst, eminent domain laws. I'm not sure if there's a connection between that and the fact that property is at more of a premium there. Those are small states that are overly populated. It's not Montana and Wyoming. But they have some of the toughest and worst eminent domain laws, and they've been the most resistant to doing some of the reforms that the other states have.
And you think with those populations, those active populations in those states, that more pressure would have been brought against state legislatures.
There was immense pressure on the Connecticut legislature. After all, this was the state that produced the Kelo case, and their governor was the one who spearheaded this whole thing. And yet, they really haven't toughened up.
Jeff Benedict, his book, really worth reading, Little Pink House, A True Story of Defiance and Courage. And we send our best wishes to Suzette Kilo, even though we were unable to speak to her today. I'm sure she's hard at work. Thank you, Jeff, for your work.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.